Today I'm gonna last time I mostly just set up a lot of notation and wrote down Einstein's equations. Just to recap, in FRW perturbation theory, it's sort of first conventional to separate out degrees of freedom into time and space like components. So these equations define just the variables, the separation of the metric tensor and various components of the stress energy into pieces that transform as scalars, three vectors, or three tensors. So the metric you can think of as a scalar A, a vector BI, a scalar HL, and a traceless symmetric tensor HT. And then the stress energy, likewise, if there were just one component, if the universe were just one fluid, then the degrees of freedom would be a density perturbation delta rho, a pressure perturbation delta p, of fluid velocity v, and a stress energy pi, or a anisotropic stress pi. And if there are multiple fluids, you just do this decomposition for every species j. So these are the variables. And I haven't fixed a gauge yet here. There's some gauge ambiguity that I can use to fix a few of the degrees of freedom. Yes, thanks. It's gauge invariant. And one way to see that is that this is a non-trivial statement. Yeah, pi is gauge invariant. So these formulas, which we'll use in detail in the proof of Weinberg's theorem, show if I have a gauge transformation, a four-vector field, which I split into time, a piece, a scalar epsilon t, that or three-scalar epsilon t, which is reparametrizing the time coordinate, and a three-vector epsilon s, which is reparametrizing the spatial coordinates, then this set of formulas tells you how it to go from one coordinate system to the next, how to transform these fields. Finally, we have Einstein's equations. So I could have SVT decomposed these gauge transformations, but I didn't. I could have written them down. You know, I could have separated in the scalar sector, there would be a variable A, a variable B, a variable HL, a variable HT with no indices. And then on the right-hand sides, you know, there would be an epsilon T and an epsilon S, two gauge degrees of freedom in the scalar sector with various functions of K here. But it'll be more convenient to have them in this three-vector form with indices rather than SVT decomposed. Einstein's equations, this is really messy. I could have if I'd wanted to go through the whole derivation, you know, I could have started by working out Einstein's equations in index form in this general setting, then specialized to a particular gauge, say Newtonian gauge, and then done the SVT decomposition. I skipped some steps here since all that we'll really need for Weinberg's theorem. I'm only going to talk about Weinberg's theorem in the Newtonian gauge. The Newtonian gauge is the one where you use the gauge freedom to fix in the scalar sector the B and HT degrees of freedom of the metric. So the metric just looks like a fluctuation in the time-time component, which is the GR generalization of the Newtonian potential. And then a fluctuation in the space-space component, a scalar fluctuation in the space-space component, which is this guy psi, which in many circumstances, most circumstances on sufficiently large scales, is just a copy of phi. And it's something that kicks in for relativistic geodesics. The equality of phi and psi is what gives the famous factor of two in the GR bending of light. So this is really just kind of a subset of Einstein's equations. I've written down Einstein's equations only in this one gauge and only in the scalar sector. But in this Newtonian gauge, they have a relatively nice physical interpretation. You have a Poisson-like equations that are telling you how phi and psi are being sourced by pressure, velocity, and anisotropic stress perturbations. The k squared here is just a delta squared in real space, so or minus delta squared. So these are Poisson equations. So in the Newtonian gauge, it appears that the potentials phi and psi respond instantaneously to fluctuations in the stress energy tensor. And then you have these continuity equations that are telling you that just enforce the requirement that energy and momentum be conserved. And these equations are incomplete. For real fluids, you'll need some microphysical equations. Which tell you one way of closing the system with microphysical equations would be to have equations that tell you the anisotropic stress pi and the pressure perturbation delta p for a given density fluctuation rho and velocity v. For example, your fluid might be a perfect fluid with no viscosity. In which case pi would be 0 and delta p would be w times delta rho. Okay. Now, Weinberg's theorem, depending on like what kind of mood I'm in, I can convince myself that this theorem is either trivial or profound. I think there's something deep about it. So Weinberg's theorem is the statement that for any reasonable equations of motion, i.e. the unspecified microphysics, and I'll try to comment on what reasonable means. In a bit, there's a solution in the scalar sector, the scalar sector Einstein equation. Equations have a solution which is called the adiabatic mode. So we can write it down. The leading terms in this solution don't depend on the microphysics. So we can write them down. Delta at a given Fourier wave number k, delta phi looks like this, with a coefficient lambda which can depend on k, where alpha t is some this function which depends on the expansion history. For any reasonable expansion history, this will be a number of order one. For example, in a constant W expansion, it's easy to do the integral and get 2/5 + 3W. If you look at how alpha is defined, I'm integrating this rapidly increasing function of time, so it only really depends on what's happened in the last few Hubble times. And then more equations, which I wrote down last time, for the other components. There's just some universal coefficients that depend on the expansion history, but not the microphysics, plus terms of higher order in k. So in delta phi, the sublinear terms start out at order k squared. It's always the combination k squared over ah which appears because it's the rate, natural scale. For a co-moving wave number is the co-moving Hubble radius ah. Okay, so let me prove this theorem, and we'll figure out where these magic coefficients come from. There's sort of a general principle in physics that whenever you have a symmetry, you should exploit it. We've exploited the translational and rotational symmetry. To diagonalize the equations by Fourier mode, and then do a further level of diagonalization with the SVT decomposition. And if you have a symmetry which is spontaneously broken, meaning that your theory is defined with a symmetry which is being broken by a specific solution, then something interesting happens. For example, Goldstone's theorem in particle physics says that if I have a spontaneously broken continuous symmetry, I'm guaranteed to get massless degrees of freedom, the degrees of freedom that are massless to all orders in perturbation theory. What's happening here is that the equations of motion have a larger symmetry. They're fully covariant, fully reparameterization invariant. That's a larger symmetry than the translation and rotation symmetry that we've used so far. But the background solution, the FRW solution, is breaking that symmetry. The FRW solution evolves in time. The background solution we're expanding around evolves in time, but is uniform in space. And so it's breaking the symmetry. There's a preferred rest frame. There's a preferred time direction. So that symmetry is, broken, and we can't really use it when we write down the equations of motion for the perturbations. They won't be invariant under any form of that symmetry. But nevertheless, something interesting happens, which is the existence of the. We can exploit this hidden symmetry to derive the existence of this adiabatic mode. So here's how the argument works. That's kind of a hand-wavy analogy with Goldstone's theorem. It seems to me that this is not exactly the same thing as Goldstone's theorem, but I think the something interesting principle always applies. Okay, so let's start by looking for a gauge symmetry. Epsilon T, epsilon S. With the following properties. I want it to preserve so if you look at these formulas for the gauge transformation, the shift in every field, say delta A, is just something. I have something on the right-hand side which depends on the gauge transformation and on the background, but not on the fluctuations. And that's just because I'm taking the gauge transformation to be first order. So the coefficient of each of these terms with epsilon has to be something of zeroth order, i.e., just background. So delta HT under the gauge symmetry is something which just depends on the background and on epsilon. And I want to require that to be zero, i.e., I want my gauge symmetry to preserve the Newtonian gauge. If I start with my metric fields in Newtonian gauge, then the gauge symmetry will leave me in Newtonian gauge. Okay, that's one condition. And then the other condition is that, so I want my shift to preserve the Newtonian gauge, and then and you'll see why this condition is interesting in a minute. The shifts in the other fields are functions of time, but not space. So as a little exercise, you can take these formulas for the gauge transformation and work out the most general epsilon T, epsilon S, I pair that satisfies these conditions. It turns out to be the following. So epsilon t, the time reparameterization part, can be an arbitrary function of time, but can't depend on x. And the spatial part has this constrained form. So it can have a term proportional to xi, where the lambda here is a constant. So that's this Gauge symmetry is just a dilation of space. Plus terms that look like this, where Wij is anti-symmetric. Now, multiplying a gauge transformation in which I multiply x by an anti-symmetric matrix to get a direction in which I shift the spatial coordinates is just an infinitesimal rotation. An anti-symmetric matrix is an infinitesimal rotation. And then, of course, this ci, a constant epsilon, just represents a uniform shift of the coordinates, i.e. a translation. So in these second two pieces here, I've just rediscovered the rotation and translation invariance of the FRW metric. So this is kind of an uninteresting piece. Say that again? No, this is constant. If you make it a function of time, then I think we'll see in a second to go through the proof. I think what happens is that you get a B. You get a BI. You get time space terms of the metric.
So this is the transformation. It's like Euclidean plus dilation.
Yeah, I mean, this form is easy to interpret. This is just a rotation plus translation. This is a dilation in space that's the same at every time. And then this is just an arbitrary reparameterization of the clock. Okay. Okay. So I'm gonna do the proof real quick. So first off, from either the delta rho or delta p equations, you see, so we want the shift in rho or p to be, we're allowing it to be a function of time. It can be non-zero, but we're allowing it to be a function of time, but it can't depend on space. And so that means that epsilon t must be a function of time only from delta p rho or delta p. From the B equation, so the shift in B we're requiring to be 0. Since we know that the spatial derivative of epsilon t has to be 0, that tells us that the time derivative of epsilon I has to be 0, i.e. epsilon I is the function of x alone. Now, if we look at the HL equation, we learn that, we're allowing the shift in HL to be a function of, it can be non-zero, but it has to be a function of time alone, not space. We know that the epsilon t piece is a function of time alone and not space. So it follows that this divergence is a function of time but not space. But we also know that this divergence is a function of space and is not allowed to depend on t because epsilon could only depend on the x's and that doesn't change when I take the derivative. So we see that this quantity, the divergence of epsilon, is something that is independent of t and is also independent of x, i.e. a constant. Okay. Now we're going to use the HT equation. Here we're requiring that the shift in HT be 0. So we can write the HT equation this way. 2/3, let's see. Okay. And we know one thing that we know, we have one extra piece of information. Well, let's see, we know the epsilon s just depends on space and not time, and we know that this quantity is a constant. So I claim that this equation forces all the second derivatives of epsilon s to be zero. And that's not particularly obvious, but you can prove it as, I had to stare at this for a bit. You can prove it as follows. First, take the partial derivative with respect to I on both sides. So we established that this is constant, so that goes away when you take the partial derivative. Okay. Now, this object, that's an object with three indices, let's call it A, I, J, K, is symmetric in the first two indices by definition. And this equation is telling us that it's anti-symmetric in its last two indices. Now, it's sort of a useful algebraic pattern, useful to remember, that in that situation, A is 0. If I have an object with three indices, which is symmetric in one pair and anti-symmetric in the other pair, it's 0. And you can prove that. So if you just kind of follow your nose, this works out. So if I start by... it's easier to just watch, I think, than to try to copy this down. So if I just start permuting, I start with A, I, J, K, and start permuting. Let's see. Well, I could decide to swap the first pair of indices. And then the only place I can go from there that doesn't just undo the previous step is to swap the second two. Let's call that minus. Then the next thing I do is swap the first two. So let's replace JK by KJ. All right. Now swap the second two, get ij, sign switches. Now swap the first two, you just keep playing this game. Then swap the last two, and you're, oh sorry, I got a sign wrong there. Swap the last two, you get the minus sign, and then you're back to where you started with the minus sign. You might compare this with the trick that's used in the GR books to derive the formula for the Christoffel symbol. You know, there's this formula. Let's write it down with the K lowered. So the GR books, the Christoffel symbol is given by this expression. And the way that derivation works is that this object here on the left-hand side, let's call it AKIJ, is symmetric in the last two indices. That's a general property of the Christoffel symbol. And it's not anti-symmetric in the first two, but we have a formula for what you get if you anti-symmetrize. The Christoffel symbol, because the covariant derivative of the metric is 0, this anti-symmetrization of the Christoffel symbol is just supposed to give you the ordinary I have something backwards. Oh yeah, this is just supposed to give you the ordinary covariant derivative of the ordinary partial derivative of the metric tensor. So anyway, in this case, you have the anti-symmetric piece is not zero, but you have a formula for it. And that means that when you run this argument, you don't get zero at the end, but you get some difference that you can keep track of. So this algebraic pattern comes up once in a while and is worth remembering. Anyway. Now that we've learned that the second derivatives are 0, that implies a function all of whose second derivatives are 0 is just a linear function. So we can write this, where the aij's are constant. And then this is a necessary condition on epsilon to satisfy this equation, but it turns out that it's not a sufficient condition. If I plug it back in to see if I have fully solved this equation or if there's something missing, then I get this. Should plug back in. Let's call this star. Okay, and so what this is telling you is that the symmetric part of the matrix A is proportional to delta ij. So this would imply that aij is some anti-symmetric guy omega minus, let me choose the minus sign here, minus something proportional to delta ij. And then now if you plug with omega ij anti-symmetric, and just for one more check, if you plug this back in either here or here, you see that you've satisfied this equation. So we finally found the necessary and sufficient condition on the function on the vector field epsilon to satisfy this equation. Okay, you can also check that. So we finally showed that epsilon s I is equal to the form we were looking for. And now you can check just to make sure we haven't missed anything and that we found the necessary and sufficient conditions for satisfying this full set of criteria. You can plug into all of these formulas, see how the various components transform, and show that these criteria are met. Okay, so that's the proof of, this is the first step in the proof of Weinberg's theorem. Okay. So what we have now, by means of this gauge transformation, is some set of, so the equations, the fact that I'm using here, even though we didn't say what these microphysical equations are, we know that whatever they are, they should be gauge invariant. And so I know that if I start with zero fluctuations in any of the fields, that's a solution of the equations of motion. That's just, we're just saying that the background is a solution of the equations of motion, which is true by definition. Now if I start with zero fluctuations and apply this gauge transformation, then I'll generate some set of fluctuations in delta phi, delta psi, and so on, which must satisfy the equations of motion. So if I work it out, if I take any gauge transformation of this type and apply the gauge transformation rules, I will satisfy the equations of motion. Let me start writing them down. Like this, the delta phi would be minus epsilon t dot. The delta psi would be h epsilon t plus lambda, et cetera. Are guaranteed to satisfy the equations of motion. But only at k equals 0, i.e. neglecting spatial derivatives. So the next question we can ask is, can you extend this solution to non-zero k? Can I add terms here of higher order in k squared over ah squared in such a way that the equations of motion continue to be satisfied? That's the idea of the proof of Weinberg's theorem. And And that's not so trivial to figure out. One property of these equations, you know, in the Newtonian gauge is that there are some equations of motion that disappear, some constraints that disappear at k equals zero. This equation, for example, if I set k to zero, it's just telling me that, well, it tells me that the anisotropic stress is equal to zero, which is something that's exactly true for this solution, because pi doesn't, as someone asked, because pi doesn't transform under the gauge transformation, it just stays zero in this mode. But it doesn't tell me that at non-zero k, this equation would tell me something more. It would tell me that phi and psi have to be equal. And that's so a necessary condition. We have to figure out the necessary and sufficient conditions. A necessary condition is that phi be equal to psi to lowest order in k. Or let's say lowest order in k squared over ah squared. And this will impose an additional constraint let's see, now for some reason I have the opposite sign in my notes. Let's look. Yeah, okay, great. This sign should be a minus. My notes were a little disorganized since I wrote the notes and then switched the sign of lambda at the end. But HL when Newtonian gauge is minus psi. The gauge transformation is defined with a minus lambda, and there's a minus here for three minus signs. Okay. So this will constrain epsilon t. If we write this out, it tells us that epsilon t dot plus h epsilon t is equal to lambda, which means that, so a nice way to solve this differential equation is to recognize this quantity as being the time derivative of a times epsilon t with an a minus here. So the solution is epsilon t at time t is equal to a of t times the integral starting at some. So the general solution would start at some arbitrary initial time, but let's start it at minus infinity of t prime. Sorry, I have this backwards. 1 over a. dt prime times a of t prime with a lambda. Yeah, okay. Now, this is, up to a factor of h, the function alpha of t that I defined before. I defined it with the h so that alpha would be dimensionless. Okay, so this condition is fixing the functional form of epsilon t. It's fixing it once lambda, the level of dilation, is fixed. So we have a one-parameter family of gauge transformations now just parameterized by lambda. Well, not quite. We would still get a solution if we change the minus infinity here to some other time. So there are actually two adiabatic mode solutions, they differ by something which falls off as 1 over a and is a decaying mode. So we're really, even though there are really two solutions, I'm only going to talk about the one solution. Well, maybe I'll mention it again at the end. the non-decaying solution where this time is chosen to be minus infinity, or you could choose any other initial time. The two choices would just differ by a multiple of the decaying mode solution. Okay. So that's a necessary condition. I want to argue that it's a sufficient condition as well. And this is the point of Weinberg's theorem that's sort of tricky. You have to argue that once this condition has been met, that you can, there are no more sort of hidden constraints that vanish in the k equals zero limit, like the one that we read off from the first equation here. For example, you might wonder about this equation. It has a 1 over k here on the right-hand side, and there's no 1 over k here. Is there some sort of problem with this equation in the k goes to 0 limit? What I'm trying to do is start with this solution. I should have written down more formulas, so write down a few more formulas. So under this transformation, so with the epsilon t fixed to this functional form, if I plug into these formulas, then delta phi, delta psi, and so on work out like this. Delta rho j for any species j. It's minus rho j dot. Delta pj minus pj dot. And delta vj starts off at 0. Now what I'm trying to do is figure out whether I can extend this to non-zero k by filling in terms here. Okay. Now, going back to the question of what's going on with this equation at non-zero k, you'll see that what it's telling you is that, let's see, so on delta rho is starting off in the series solution at zeroth order in k squared over ah squared. And on the left-hand side, I have to get something that's second order, suppressed by 2 powers of k squared. The only way that that can work out is that if I choose the, I have to choose the order k term in V so that when I divide by k to get a zeroth order piece, it cancels off the k to the zero piece here, leaving behind the right-hand side, which is second order in k over ah as required by the left-hand side. So to get the cancellation at lowest order on the right-hand side here, you'll need to start Vj like this. It has to look like, by that equation, it has to start off like this. It's k over ah, which is, in terms of lambda, rho j dot 3. H, which is alpha over H times K over AH, plus terms of order K cubed over AH cubed. And this is the first step in starting with, so V is, you know, zero at zeroth order, which is what you'd read off from these gauge transformations. But using the equations of motion, we can figure out like the first subleading term. And you can sort of convince yourself that you can go through, as you start satisfying equations of motion to higher and higher order in k, you can go through and just start reading off coefficients one at a time. The forms of the subleading coefficients will depend on the microphysical equations of motion, but the leading coefficients here are just fixed by the background. That would be a totally equivalent way of doing the counting. Yeah. We've shown with what we have on the board here so far, we can guarantee, by the way, an important consistency check is to note that if I use what I have on the board so far, then this equation is satisfied at zeroth order in k. For my solution so far, I haven't used this equation yet in constructing the solution, but I have written down the order k term in v and the order k to the zero terms here. And so you can check that if I just plug in, the leading terms that I've written down so far, that this equation is satisfied at lowest order. So I've gotten far enough along in the power series solution that I can guarantee that all of these equations are satisfied to their lowest order, their respective lowest orders in k. And now you can just sort of go through and look at the subleading terms. This is a subleading term. This is coming in at order k squared. And you can just integrate. That sources this left-hand side. You can just integrate and work out what term at order k squared you need to put into delta rho and delta p and build up these subleading terms in the power series expansion. Weinberg has the argument presented a little more formally in his paper. You can always check it if you have a given set of microphysical equations and you're worried about it. You can always stare at the equations of motion and convince yourself that this power series solution is possible. So this is Weinberg's theorem. Oh yeah, one more comment. In the context of single field inflation, so we parameterized. I forgot a lambda here. We did this argument 1k mode at a time. Because this is a linear system of differential equations, we found a solution which is determined up to some constant multiplier lambda. And of course, since this whole picture is happening at every k mode, the lambda can be a function of k. And these quantities on the left-hand side are all functions of k. So we have. When we say we have one mode, one adiabatic mode, we really mean a whole 3D field's worth of degrees of freedom. In fact, this lambda, so when we talked about single field inflation, let's try to connect this discussion of Weinberg's theorem to single field inflation. In single field inflation, we found that there's only one dynamical scalar degree of freedom, zeta. So because there's only one mode, only one dynamical degree of freedom, and we're guaranteed to have one mode that satisfies the adiabatic mode, which satisfies the equation of motion, we know that they have to be equal. The zeta that you get in single field inflation must be up to some constant factor, the function lambda appearing here, and furthermore, that at the end of single field inflation, the universe must be in its adiabatic mode because there's only one mode around. So if you work out, if you go back to the gauge that we chose for single field inflation, change to Newtonian gauge, you will find that single field inflation is in this adiabatic mode. You'll get exactly the coefficients that you need. And the lambda turns out to be equal to the quantity zeta that we defined before. I didn't want to build in this assumption, but adiabatic mode is usually written with a zeta. You say that the universe is in its adiabatic mode if there's some scalar field zeta with all of the coefficients of the metric and the stress energies of the different fields given by this universal set of formulas. So coming out of single field inflation, because there's only one degree of freedom around, you must be in the adiabatic mode. And it follows that what happens is we run inflation. You know, we have this inflaton coming down the hill, and then it eventually gets to the bottom of its potential and decays to standard model particles. And now we have a bunch of degrees of freedom around. But we know, because we were in the adiabatic mode at some point in the past, that we must still be in the adiabatic mode. I mean, this is a system of differential equations with a solution that we know about. And we know that at some time, we were in that solution. We have to be in that same solution at later times. We know that after reheating, at the beginning of the hot Big Bang phase, we know what initial conditions single field slow roll inflation predicts, what initial perturbations it predicts in all of the fields. You might ask, well, so Weinberg's theorem is used in practice as a way of as giving a natural choice for the initial conditions at the beginning of the hot Big Bang phase. And the theorem shows that those initial conditions are correct for any single field model of inflation. You might ask, well, this isn't just a statement about the state of the universe at the end of inflation and the beginning of the hot Big Bang phase. It's actually true at all times, right? I mean, we showed that this is a solution of the equations of motion, period, no caveats, for all times. So isn't it also true that at some later point in the universe's evolution, like at the time that the CMB is generated, I guess the perturbations still have to be small enough that they're linear, but isn't it true that at a redshift of 1,000, the universe is still in its adiabatic mode? The answer is, yes, that's true formally, but K over AH can be large. Like when we work out the perturbation theory of the CMB, we're interested in values of KH that are of order 10, say, or thereabouts. So just knowing these leading coefficients in a series expansion isn't very useful if the expansion parameter is of order 1 or larger. So it's not convenient to try to solve the... You could use the equations of motion to construct these higher order terms. That would be like solving a set of differential equations in a power series. But that's not particularly useful in this regime. And in practice, what one does, of course, is just do ordinary differential integration of the differential equations. So in practice, Weinberg's theorem is useful when K over AH is small. And it's used to set up the initial conditions at the beginning of the hot Big Bang phase for subsequent evolution integration. Okay. So I'll talk a little bit about, in the last lecture, I'm going to talk a little bit about reheating. Let me just, since I have 10 minutes left, I'll do like a little 10-minute warm-up. I'm going to talk about a simple model of reheating where we have a slow roll potential. We roll down the potential and go through a few e-foldings of slow roll inflation. And then after a while, we get to a steep part of the potential. Where slow roll inflation ends. And then we end up maybe sitting at the bottom of the potential for a while. And then the inflaton particles decay, we assume, since our universe isn't made out of inflatons, that there's some decay of the inflaton to the standard model. I want to analyze, what we know is that we'll end up in the adiabatic mode at the end. In other words, you know, Weinberg's theorem is giving us the powerful statement that regardless of the contents of this black box, regardless of the details of how reheating happens, we end up in the adiabatic mode. But I'm going to talk a little bit about the physics just to give sort of an idea of what's going on here. And also because reheating can be more interesting in multi-field models of inflation where Weinberg's theorem doesn't apply. Okay, so as a warm-up for thinking about reheating, I want to think about a free massive scalar field. In FRW. So I'm thinking about a field with this action. With spatial fluctuations neglected, with no spatial fluctuations. So I'm going to be ignoring spatial derivatives. Assuming that phi is just a function of time and that the scale factor is just a function of time. So I'm going to be integrating some ordinary differential equations, no partial differential equations or Fourier mode analysis. And I'm going to think about this. So first, let's write the equations of motion. So for this action, the FRW energy density is 1 half phi dot squared plus 1 half m squared phi squared. The FRW pressure is the same thing with the minus sign. Potential energy behaves as a component with W equals minus 1, and kinetic energy behaves as a component with W equals plus 1. The equation of motion, of course, I have Friedman's equation, the equation of motion for A, the equation of motion for phi is this. Where the H, so I am going to assume that in addition to this phi field, there are other fields around which are driving the expansion. So I'll assume that the total H squared of the universe is an H squared due to other stuff. Plus the contribution from this energy, rho over 3 m Planck squared. Let's call that h phi squared. Okay. So this is a simple, this is a well-defined setup. And I want to understand the evolution of the scalar field. The full equation of motion is a complicated nonlinear one. I mean, I haven't really told you how this, what I'm going to be assuming for this. But even without this, the phi dot squared, you know, is coming in as a nonlinear term in the equation of motion. So I doubt it, as far as I know, it can't be solved exactly. But we'll solve it in some special limits. I'm going to consider the case where the total Hubble constant of the universe is either much larger than the mass of the oscillator M or much less than. And then I'll also divide things up based on whether the total energy density of the universe is dominated by the other stuff or by phi. Okay, so I'm going to analyze these four cases. Okay, so first let's consider this case.
Okay.
Each other. So in this case, each other is some large compared to M, external function of time, which appears in the friction term for the field. Now you might guess that's what's going to happen. You know, if I have a huge friction, a friction whose time scale is much larger than the time scale of the oscillator, that the field is just going to be pinned and not oscillate back and forth in its M squared phi squared potential. And that is what happens, although, you know, my initial guess for what was going to happen here was that by analogy with single field slow roll inflation, you might guess that this is a good approximation to the equation of motion. That if you're in this frozen situation, that the phi double dot term is small. But if you do the kind of analysis that we did, so in other words, phi dot, we might expect to be parametrically of order m squared over 3 h other. M squared phi. If you do the analysis, the type of analysis that we did for single field inflationary models, where we checked the validity of approximations like this by assuming they were the truth, and then on this on the solution to this approximate equations of motion, checking that this term is small, then it actually doesn't work. But what is general? So this statement is actually false, but this statement turns out to still be true. For example, so this is too simple. This is a little too simple. For example, if the external expansion has a constant equation of state W, then with a little playing around, I determined that phi dot is this weird function of W times m squared over h phi, not minus 1/3. But this is OK. The correction is always of order 1. So if we ask how far, if we want to, if you accept this statement, and we want to check that we really are frozen here and we don't all go all the way down to the bottom, we can ask how many, what fractional change in phi do we get in one period of the oscillator? Its natural period is 1 over m. And so this statement implies that phi dot over m phi dot is order m over h, which we're assuming is much less than 1. So in one period of the oscillator, I get a fractional change in its position, which is much less than order 1. In fact, this integral, for any sort of reasonable expansion history, the integral of m over h of t will be much less than 1. And so throughout the whole integrated history of the universe, this field never makes it through a single oscillation, so it really is frozen. OK. So while the Hubble constant, if I have an oscillator like this, and it starts, say it starts out with phi dot equals 0 in some point in its potential, and it lives in an FRW universe which is expanding and h is decreasing, then one thing that we figured out is that while the Hubble constant is larger than m, the field is frozen. While it's frozen, because phi dot is small, the equation of state is close to minus 1. So in this regime, the oscillator just behaves like a source of potential energy. We'll stop here because it's 10:15. In the next class, I'll work out these other three cases real quick, and then we'll talk about reheating.